him here, didn't I?
Did Tag go home? Asked Charles.
Heather looked up at him, examining his face. He said he'd had all the blood he could deal with for a while and went downstairs to watch a movie. Your Jack will be fine, Anna said, apparently impatient with Charles's neutrality. Charles and I are going to take care of the werewolf who attacked him, and hopefully that will be good enough that your friend won't freak out to the press. Heather stared at this Anna for a moment. Thank goodness for someone around here who doesn't act as if information were more precious than gold. You must be Charles's Chicago Omega. Anna smiled, but he could tell that she had to work at it. Wolves do tend to be secretive, don't they? If it helps, I think you're bringing the other wolf, Tag, was it? Was the thing that tipped the balance. Heather glanced at Charles out of the corner of her eye, and he knew she'd hoped for that when she called her uncle for help. Still, he read the truth in her voice when she said, He was the only one it occurred to me to call. I knew he'd come just because I asked him. Tag was like that.
Is it possible that we could wake your Jack up? Asked Charles.
He's been in and out, she told him. He's just sleeping, not unconscious now.
The human was a little older than Heather. His face was drawn and pale. As soon as Heather woke him up, the scent of his pain filled the room. Interesting, thought Brother Wolf, seeing wounded prey. An easy meal.
Charles had never figured out if Brother Wolf was serious or being funny, since they both knew he'd never allow them to feed upon a human. He suspected, uncomfortably, that it was somewhere in between. He pushed Brother Wolf back and waited until the human focused on him over Heather's shoulder.
I'm Charles, he said, a werewolf. Heather, I'm not going to eat him.
Heather backed out from between them, though he could tell she wanted to stay there and protect her friend from him.
Why did you attack us?
Jack whispered, working to get the words out.
Not me, Charles said. Ask Heather, she'll tell you. We just heard about the rogue a few days ago. I was wounded and my father wanted to wait until I was healed before sending me after him. We thought that, with the hunting season almost over, there was little danger in waiting a couple of weeks.
Wounded?
Charles gritted his teeth to control the wolf, who was wildly disapproving, as he untucked his shirt and turned around. The burn across his shoulders was obvious, but he'd also been smelling his own blood since Anna had fishtailed, so he was pretty sure that the current bandage was bloodstained where it covered the hole in his back. Neither Jack nor Heather was a threat, but Brother Wolf didn't care. Displaying weakness for others was wrong. But it was important that Jack understood why they had waited. If they wanted him to keep quiet, Jack had to understand that they were capable of policing their own under normal circumstances.
Bullet burn, said Jack.
And two more than hit,
Charles agreed, retucking his shirt.
Jack used to be a policeman, offered Heather.
She kept her head averted, not looking at him, and Charles appreciated it.
I had some problems in Chicago a few days ago, Charles said.
You'll need to heal, Jack whispered.
Charles shook his head.
Not if we have a werewolf out hunting people.
He looked at Heather.
Was this unprovoked?
She shrugged. I don't know for sure. He just broke cover and attacked. There are a lot of reasons the rogue could have done that. Maybe he set up territory or has something or someone he's guarding. But I barely tagged him and he ran.
So, he could be hunting, Charles concluded. We can't afford to wait for him to find someone else to kill.
Anna followed Charles down the stairs in a hunt for Heather's uncle, Tag. The stairs ended in a narrow hall lined with steel doors, complete with thick iron bars ready to be set in the brackets on either side. On one of the doors the bar was in use. Whoever was in it had been making noise until they stepped out into the hall. Then he dropped into utter silence, and she could feel him listening to them as they walked by. She might have asked Charles about it, but his face didn't invite questions. She couldn't tell if he was mad at her or just thinking. Either way, she didn't want to bother him. She had already annoyed him enough. She should have told him that she would stay behind. but that would have meant he would go alone, wounded, to face some unknown rogue. His father seemed to think he could take care of himself, but he hadn't been there yesterday when Charles had been too hurt to move without help. If Charles decided he didn't want her, what would she do? There was a friendlier door at the end of the hall, no locks or bars, but as they approached it, she heard the sound of an explosion. "Hoo-yah!" someone said with fierce appreciation. Charles opened the door without knocking. Anna had a quick impression of a huge TV screen connected to a variety of sleek black boxes and speakers by a rainbow spiderweb of cables. But what caught her eye and held it was a big man stretched over the back of a couch like a giant house cat. And giant was the word. Charles was a tall man, but she'd be willing to bet that Colin Taggart was taller by several inches and broader all the way around. Despite the cold, he wore Birkenstock sandals on his big feet, strapped over a pair of heavy wool socks, worn and frayed but clean. Baggy khaki pants were topped by a tie-dyed t-shirt hanging down past his thighs. His hair was spectacularly orange-red and coarse like a pony's mane. It curled and matted in a hairstyle that might have been a deliberate attempt at dreadlocks, or just lack of care. He'd pulled the whole mass away from his face with a substantial, ink-stained rubber band. He hadn't been at the funeral, she thought. She'd have remembered him. Probably, he'd been out getting his niece. His skin was kelt pale, with freckles dusted across his cheekbones. With his coloring and blade-sharp features, he might as well have Irish tattooed across his forehead. He smelled of some odd incense that overlaid a pleasant earthy tone that she couldn't quite place. He looked 10 or 15 years younger than his niece, and the only thing they had in common was the clear gray of their eyes. After a quick glance at Charles when they entered the room, Tag turned his attention back to the TV and watched the last of the explosion, then aimed the remote in the TV's general direction and paused the movie. "So," he said in a surprisingly high voice, "you don't smell like death." It wasn't soprano, but a man that big should rumble like a bass drum. He sounded more like a clarinet. An American clarinet. His accent was pure TV announcer.
"If Heather's friend can keep his mouth shut, he'll be safe enough," said Charles. "We're going hunting bright and early in the morning. I'd appreciate it if you could do a few things for me."
The relaxed pose had been a ruse, Anna realized, as the other werewolf sat up and allowed himself to slide down onto the seat of the couch and used that momentum to come all the way to his feet, all with the controlled speed and grace of a danseur noble. Standing, he took up more than his share of the small room. Anna took an involuntary step back that neither of the men appeared to notice. He grinned, but his eyes were wary, and he kept them on Charles.
"All right, then. As long as you're not going to kill my little friend, I'll be happy to oblige."
"I need you and Heather to figure out exactly where they were when they were attacked, preferably on a map. See if she can pinpoint where the other werewolf victim was, and the grad students attacked, too."
Charles glanced back at Anna, giving her an impersonal once-over before turning his attention back to the other man.
"Then stop by Jenny's and see if she has some dirty clothes, something she sweated in."
The wolf's eyes narrowed.
"You're going to do that scent thing? Jenny Harrison is about your size. Do you want me to grab something of his for you?"
"That would be good. Meet us back at my house in a couple of hours with the map and clothes."
"Bran's really not going to execute Heather's man?"
It was a statement, but there was a thread of uncertainty in Tag's voice. Charles shrugged.
"Not right now, anyway. Not unless he decides to do something dumb."
It didn't sound like reassurance to Anna, but Tag seemed to take it that way.
"Fine, then,"
he said with a nod.
"See you in a couple of hours."
Charles parked the Humvee in front of the house, probably because it wouldn't have fit in the garage. He was stiff and limping by that time, but when Anna tried to take the packages they'd amassed from the store, he just gave her a look. She raised both hands in surrender and let him take everything into the house himself. He hadn't said anything personal to her since they left his father's study.
"Maybe you ought to take someone else,"
she said, finally, as she shut out the winter's cold.
"Another wolf might be more helpful."
Charles turned and looked her in the face. He slowly took off his gloves while he stared at her, his eyes black in the dimmer light of the house. She met his gaze for a breath or two before dropping her own eyes.
"I don't like bringing reinforcements to a kill,"
he told her after a moment.
"More wolves tend to muck things up."
He took off his coat and set it deliberately across the back of the couch.
"This is a werewolf who is killing humans. It might be a plant, someone who intends to stop my father's plans to carefully unveil our presence to the humans. I've been considering that, though, and I don't think that's what's going on. It would take a desperate person to go into the cabinets this time of year when Missoula or Kalispell are so much more convenient and more sure to attract attention. Running around in the wilderness in winter is too much trouble, I think, for a planned attack or a hardened killer. I think we're dealing with a rogue, someone who doesn't know much and is trying to keep out of sight. Dangerous, as he has so ably demonstrated, but nothing I can't handle."
"I'll do as you tell me," she told the floor, feeling stupid for insisting on going, and heartsick because he didn't want her with him. "I'll try not to get in the way."
"I would not have considered taking you without my father's insistence," he said slowly. "And I would have been wrong."
His words took her totally by surprise. Half suspecting that she'd mistaken him, she looked up to see his sheepish smile.
"I think," he said, "that even a werewolf deserves a chance, don't you? A rogue hiding out in the cabinets is pretty desperate, and there's a good chance he's as much a victim as the dead hunter and Heather's Jack. But even if I knew for certain he was only moonstruck, out of control through no fault of his own, I'd still probably have to kill him if I went alone. But look at what you did with Osiel this morning. If you come with me, we just might be able to give this wolf a chance."
She weighed his words, but he seemed serious.
"You aren't angry? Don't wish I'd kept my mouth shut?"
He closed the distance between them and kissed her. When he pulled back, her heart was pounding, and not from fear. She could see his pulse beat in his throat, and he smelled of the crisp, snow-covered outdoors.
"No," he murmured. "I don't want you to keep quiet."
He ran a light finger down her jaw.
"Tag will be here in a minute. Let me fix some food before he does."
Though he was obviously still sore and claimed not to be much of a cook, he fixed the stew she'd been organizing when Bran had called. He did send her for the potatoes, which he kept hidden downstairs in a 50-pound gunny sack, but otherwise seemed perfectly content to do all the work himself. She watched him cook, and the euphoria induced by his kiss faded. Here was a man used to being alone, used to depending upon himself. He didn't need her, but she was completely dependent on him. While they waited for the stew to simmer, he turned on the small TV in the dining room, the only TV she'd seen in his house, and a cheery woman in bright lipstick told him it was going to be colder tomorrow. He sat down, and she took a chair on the opposite side of his oak dining table.
"As local as we get," Charles told her, as they watched the forecast. "Missoula and Kalispell."
She wasn't sure why she didn't just let the TV fill in the time.
"Your father told me I should ask you about contacting my family," Anna said,
while the anchorwoman introduced a story on local Christmas shopping over the weekend. Retail sales down from last year. Internet sales up.
"Is there some problem with them?"
"I don't know. I haven't talked to them since shortly after I changed."
"You haven't talked to your family for 3 years?"
He frowned at her. Then a look of comprehension came to his face.
"He didn't let you."
She looked at him a moment.
"Leo said that any human even suspected of knowing about us would be killed." and any prolonged contact with my family would be adequate cause to eliminate them. At his suggestion, I took offense at something my sister-in-law said and haven't spoken to them since.
Idiot, snapped Charles, then shook his head at her. Not you. Leo, why should... I suppose he thought your family would object to the treatment you were receiving and cause a fuss. And I hope he was right. If you'd like to call him right now, go ahead. Or when we get back from this, we can fly to your family for a visit. Some things are best explained in person.
Her throat closed up, and she tried to blink back sudden, stupid tears. I'm sorry, she managed. He leaned toward her, but before he could say anything, they both heard the unmistakable sound of a car driving up. Without knocking, Tag blew in like a warm blizzard, a paper bag in one hand and a map in the other. Here you are, he stopped and sniffed appreciatively. Tell me there's enough for a third. I've been out on your errands and haven't gotten a bite to eat.
Help yourself, said Charles dryly, since Tag had dumped his burdens and was already in the kitchen.
Anna heard him rattle around for a moment, and then he was striding into the dining room with three bowls of stew in his big hands. He set one in front of Anna, one in front of Charles, and one at a place next to Charles. Another visit, and he had three glasses of milk and spoons. He handled the dishes with a professionalism that made Anna think that he'd spent some time as a waiter somewhere. He kept an eye on Charles while he sat down, and Anna realized something that she'd been noticing subconsciously for a long time. Despite his casual demeanor, Tag was afraid of Charles, just as Sage had been for all of her Charlies. There was a reason, Anna thought, that Brand's mate Leah had come when Charles was occupied elsewhere, why she'd been unfamiliar with the house. Anna had recognized Heather's fear, but Heather was human. The others were all werewolves, and their reaction was in subtle body movements, like Tag's watchfulness. Tag took a couple of slurping spoonfuls that Anna's mother would have slapped his hand for, then told Charles,
She needs feeding up. Leo never could take care of the gifts he was given.
He wasn't given, Anna, Charles said. He hunted her down.
Tag's face stilled.
He changed an omega by force?
Shock, Anna thought, and disbelief.
No, Charles said. He hunted her, and when he found her, he set a mad dog after her.
It'd take a crazy bastard to attack an omega. You kill him?
The casualness of Tag's voice was a little too studied to be real.
Yes.
Leo, too?
Yes.
Good.
Tag looked at her without meeting her eyes, then started in on his dinner again.
I wasn't an omega then, Anna said. I was just a human.
Charles gave her a small smile and started eating his stew.
You were born an omega. Just as my father was dominant and dangerous from his first step, human or not. Being a werewolf just springs it out. An age puts a polish on it.
She doesn't know that?
Tag asked.
Leo did his best to keep her ignorant, and under his thumb, Charles told him.
Tag raised a fuzzy red eyebrow at her.
I never liked Leo. Too damned underhanded by half. It's hard for a dominant wolf to hurt a submissive wolf if he's sane. Our instincts tell us to protect them. Omega is one step beyond that. When you were human, you'd have been even more fragile than you are now. Just ups those instincts. A human Omega is something that it takes a mad dog, a wolf crazy with killing, to attack.
Both men had started eating again before Anna decided to challenge his statement. None of the wolves in Leo's pack seem to have trouble hurting me. Tag's eyes met Charles's, and she remembered that there was a wolf underneath the brash cheeriness.
They should have had trouble, said Charles harshly. If Leo hadn't pushed, they'd have let you be.
None of them stood up to him?
Tag asked.
He'd weeded out the strong ones already, said Charles. The others were under his thumb. They jumped when he told them.
You sure you killed him?
Asked Tag.
Yes.
Tag's eyes skated across her again.
Good.
As soon as everyone finished eating, Tag got the map he'd brought and spread it over the table. Anna collected the dirty dishes and cleaned up after dinner while Charles and Tag mumbled over the map.
All the attacks were within a few miles of Bari Lake,
Tag was saying when she came back to peer over Charles's shoulder.
There's an old cabin in those woods, I've heard, but I've never seen it.
I know where it is. That's a good thought.
Charles tapped a finger on the map.
It's about there, not too far from the attacks. I haven't been out to Bari Lake in the winter for 10 or 15 years. Is this still the best road?
That's the way I went in today. You want to take this little road here,
he pointed, but Anna didn't see a road.
That's right, Charles said. Then we'll hike over Silver Butte Pass.
Now, the first attack was up this way,
he pointed slightly to the left of Bari Lake.
Right on the trail you take in the summer, a couple of miles from the lake. The dead hunter was found here, about a half mile from the lake. He probably came up Silver Butte Pass, like you're going to. We had a lot of snow in late October. By hunting season, the old Forest Service road would already have been impassable. Heather and Jack were attacked here, about 4 miles from their truck. I was able to drive another quarter of a mile closer. You'll be able to do a little better in the Humvee.
Charles hummed, then said,
It could be a lot worse. We could be trying to get to Vimy Ridge.
Tag laughed shortly.
Which is where you'd haul up. I wouldn't want to be the wolf hunting you in that place in high summer, let alone midwinter. Happily, Bari Lake is as close to a Sunday hike as you can find in the cabinets.
He looked at Anna.
Not that it's easy, mind you, but possible. The only way to get to Vimy Ridge in this weather is by chopper. The snowpack can get over 14 feet deep in some of the high country. You'll see some of that up there in the ridges above Bari. You go with this old Lobo and you listen to him or, werewolf or not, we'll likely be out searching for your dead body.
No need to frighten her,
Charles said. Tag leaned back in his chair and smiled.
She's not afraid, are you, Dovey?
And in that last phrase, she heard a hint of an Irish lilt, or maybe Cockney. She might have a good ear, but she needed more than 3 words. Tag looked at Charles.
Heather had to hike to the high stuff to call me. Most of the cabinets still don't get cell phone reception. I parked here,
he tapped the map.
And walking around a little bit, I found cell reception. I suggest you park near there and leave the cell phones in the car.
Charles gave him a sharp look.
In case this isn't a lone rogue?
You and Bran aren't the only ones who can add 2 and 2,
Tag said.
If this is an attack of some sort, you don't want to let the villains track you by that neat little locator cell phones carry nowadays.
I hadn't intended to,
agreed Charles. He leaned over the map again.
Just from the attacks, it looks as though Bari is the center of his territory, but...
Once the snow falls, you aren't going to get a lot of people east or west of the lake,
Tag said decisively.
Bari Lake could as easily be the edge of his territory as the center.
Charles frowned.
I don't think we'll find him to the east. If he was in that big valley on the other side of the ridge above Bari, the natural lay of the land would set his territory through the valley, and maybe up to Buck Lake or even Wandless. But not over the ridge. That climb out of the valley to Bari is next to impossible this time of year, even on 4 feet.
West, then.
Charles ran a finger from Bari to a couple of smaller lakes.
I think we'll go to Bari and head west, over to the Bear Lakes through Iron Meadows and back over this mountain to the V. If we haven't encountered him by then, I think it'll be time to call out the whole pack.
You'll have to be careful. There's a lot of avalanche country up by the Bears,
Tag said. But Anna could hear the approval in his voice. They spent some time planning a route that would take 4 days to hike. When they were finished, Tag touched his hand to his forehead as if tugging an invisible hat.
Pleased to meet you, ma'am,
he told Anna. Then, without giving her time to say anything, he left, as precipitously as he had come. Chapter 6. He likes you, Charles said, folding up the map. How do you know that? She asked.
People he doesn't like, he doesn't talk to.
He started to say something else but lifted his head and stared at the door with a frown instead.
I wonder what he wants.
Once he drew her attention to it, she heard the car drive up too.
Who?
She asked, but he didn't answer, just stalked out to the living room, leaving her to follow hesitantly. Charles jerked open the door, revealing the wolf from the funeral, a seal. He had one hand raised to knock on the door. In the other, he had a bouquet of flowers, mostly yellow roses, but there were a few purple daisy-looking things, too. Asil adjusted to the reordering of his entrance smoothly, gifting Anna with a smile while avoiding Charles's gaze. It might have been the proper and right response to an obviously irritated wolf who was more dominant, except that his eyes were boldly locked on Anna's.
I brought an apology, he said, for the lady.
He was, Anna noticed, almost a foot shorter than Charles, just an inch or two taller than she was. Standing next to Charles, she could see that their coloring was similar, dark skin and darker eyes and hair, black in artificial light, but the skin tone was different, and Asil's features were sharper, Middle Eastern, rather than Native American.
For my lady, said Charles, slowly, with a growl in his voice.
Asil smiled brilliantly, the wolf apparent in his face for an instant before it faded.
For your lady, of course. Of course.
He handed the flowers to Charles, then said silkily,
She doesn't carry your scent, Charles, which is why I made the mistake.
He glanced up at Charles slyly, smiled again, then turned on his heel and all but ran back out to his car, which was still idling. Anna hugged herself against the rage that she sensed sweeping through Charles, though she didn't understand why Asil's last words had made him so angry. Charles shut the door and silently held out the flowers. But there was a savageness in the tension of his shoulders and body language that made Anna put her hands behind her and take a step back. She didn't want anything to do with Asil's flowers if they made Charles so angry. He looked at her then, instead of through her, and something tightened further in the muscles of his face.
I'm not Leo or Justin, Anna. These are yours. They're pretty, and they smell good, better than most flowers. Asil has a hothouse, and he seldom cuts the blooms from his plants. He was grateful for your help this morning, or he wouldn't have done it. That he could goad me when he gave them to you just made him a little happier. You should enjoy them.
His words didn't match the fury she could smell, and even though Charles thought she didn't use her nose very effectively, she had learned to believe it over her ears. She couldn't manage to meet his eyes, but she did take the flowers and walk into the kitchen, where she stopped. She had no idea where she could find a vase. She heard a noise behind her, and he sat down on the counter, one of the pottery jars from the living room.
This should be about the right size, he said.
When she just stood there, he filled the jar with water himself. Slowly, so not to spook her, she thought, he took the bouquet, trimmed the ends of the flowers, and arranged them with more expedience than art. The sudden shock of fear, followed by shame for her cowardice, took her a while to work through. And she didn't want to compound matters by saying the wrong thing, or doing the wrong thing. I'm sorry, she said. Her stomach was so tight it was hard to breathe. I don't know why I get so stupid. He stopped fussing with the last flower, a purple one. Slowly, so she had plenty of time to back away, he put a finger under her chin and tilted it up.
You've known me less than a week, he told her. No matter how it sometimes feels. Not nearly enough time to learn to trust. It's all right, Anna. I am patient, and I won't hurt you if I can help it.
She looked up, expecting black eyes, and met golden instead. but his hand on her was still gentle, even with the wolf so close.
"It is I who am sorry," he said.
Apologizing, she thought, as much for the wolf as for his brief display of temper.
"This is new to me as well."
He grinned at her, a flash and gone. The oddly boyish expression managed to make him look sheepish despite a certain sharp edge.
"I'm not used to being jealous, or having so little control. It's not just the bullet wounds, though they don't help."
They stood there for a while more, his hand under her chin. Anna was afraid to move for fear she would provoke the rage that kept his eyes wolf yellow, or do something that might hurt him the way she'd hurt him with her flinch. She didn't know what Charles was waiting for. He spoke first.
"My father told me that there was something bothering you when you left the church this morning. Was it Asil? Or was it something else?"
She took a step sideways. He let her go, but his hand slid from her face to her shoulder, and she couldn't make herself take another step and lose that touch. He was going to think she was a neurotic idiot if she didn't get a better grip on herself. "Nothing was bothering me. I'm fine."
He sighed. "Six words and two lies. Anna, I'm going to have to teach you how to smell a lie. Then you won't try them with me."
He pulled his hand back, and she could have cried out at the loss, even though part of her wanted nothing to do with him.
"You can just tell me you don't want to talk about it."
Tired of herself, Anna rubbed her face, puffed out her cheeks, then blew like a winded horse. Finally, she lifted her gaze and met his again. "I'm a mess," she told him. "Mostly, I don't know what I'm feeling, or why. And I don't want to talk about the rest yet. Or ever. To anyone." She was a stupid coward, and had gotten herself into a situation in which she was helpless. When they got back from the mountains, she would find a job with money in the bank and something constructive to do. She could get her bearings. He tilted his head.
"I can understand that. You've been uprooted from everything you know, dumped among strangers, and had all the rules you knew pulled out from under your feet. It's gonna take some time to get used to. If you have questions about anything, just ask. If you don't want to talk to me, you can catch my father or... Sage? You liked Sage?"
"I liked Sage." Did she have any questions? Her irritation at herself transferred to him just fine. Even though she could tell he didn't mean to treat her like a child, he wasn't trying to be patronizing, only trying to help. It wasn't his fault that his soothing tone put her teeth on edge, especially when she could tell he was still angry about something. Did she like Sage? As if he had to go out and find friends for her. She was tired of being afraid and uncertain. He wanted questions. She'd been taught not to ask. Werewolves keep secrets as if they were gold in a vault. Fine. What was it that Asil said that pushed you from irritated to enraged?
"He threatened to try to take you from me," he told her.
She thought over the conversation, but didn't see it. When?
"It takes more than this attraction between us to seal us together as a mated pair. When he told me that you didn't smell of me, he was telling me he knew we haven't completed the mating, and that he considered you fair game."
She frowned at him.
"We haven't made love," he told her. "And there's a formal ceremony under the full moon that cements our bonds, a wedding. Without those, Asil can still make a play for you without retaliation."
Yet another thing she'd never heard before. If she had been 10 years younger, she'd have stamped her foot. "Is there a book?" she demanded hotly. "Something I can look up all this stuff in?"
"You can write one," he suggested.
If she hadn't been watching his mouth, she'd never have seen the flash of humor. He thought she was funny. "Maybe I will," she said darkly, and turned on her heel. Except there was nowhere to go. His bedroom? She shut herself in the bathroom and turned on the shower to hide any sound she made, a second barrier because the door she'd locked behind her wasn't enough. She stared at herself in the mirror, which was beginning to fog. The blurring reflection only enhanced the illusion that she was looking at a stranger, someone she despised for cowardice and uncertainty, who was good for nothing except waiting tables. But that was nothing new. She'd hated herself ever since she'd been turned into this monster. A pathetic monster at that. Her eyes looked bruised, her cheeks pale. She remembered her panicked retreat from Charles's brief show of temper, how she'd helplessly apologized for forcing her company upon him in this expedition. And she despised herself even more. She didn't used to be like this. It wasn't Charles's fault, so why was she so angry with him? Viciously, she stripped out of her clothes and stepped into the steaming shower, feeling some relief as the pain from too hot water sliced through the stupid tangle of emotion she was wallowing in. And in that moment of clarity, she understood why she'd been so upset by the end of the funeral, and why she was so upset with Charles in particular. She hadn't realized how much she wanted to be human again. She knew it was impossible, knew nothing could undo the magic that had been forced upon her, but that didn't mean she didn't want it. For 3 years, she'd lived with monsters, had been one of them. Then Charles had come. He was so different from them. He'd given her hope. But that wasn't fair. It wasn't his fault. Part of her had decided that she wasn't just leaving her pack, she was leaving the monsters behind. He never lied to her. He'd told her he was his father's enforcer, and she hadn't doubted it. She'd seen him fight, seen him kill. Even so, somehow she'd managed to convince herself that Montana would be different, that she could be normal, could be human, every day except for the full moon, and even that would be different here, where there was room to run without hurting anyone. She should have known better. She did know better. It wasn't Charles's fault that he was a monster, too. It had been easy to lay the destruction of the Chicago Pack's holding cell on the silver poisoning, but tonight, confronting Aseel, he'd shown her that he wasn't any different than any other male werewolf, angry, possessive, and dangerous. She'd allowed herself to believe that it was just the Chicago Pack, that the mess Leo and his mate had created was the reason for the terrible thing the pack had been. She'd wanted a knight in shining armor, a voice of reason in the madness, and Charles had provided it for her. Did he know that was what she'd been looking for? Had he done it deliberately? As the water matted her hair and ran into her eyes and over her cheeks like tears, her last question clarified and answered her greatest fear. Of course Charles hadn't set out to be her knight deliberately. That was just who he was. He was a werewolf, dominant enough to back down the alpha of a pack without the resources an alpha could draw on. He was his father's hitman, an assassin feared even by other members of his own pack. He could have been like Justin, ravening and cruel. Instead, he knew the madness of what they were and managed not just to overcome it, but to use it, to make something better. She had the sudden picture of his beautiful hands gently arranging flowers while his wolf craved violence in the worst way. Charles was a monster, his father's assassin. She wouldn't allow herself to believe a lie again. If Bran had told him to, he would have killed Jack, killed him knowing that the human was only a victim and that he was probably a good man. But it wouldn't have been casual. She'd seen the relief that had flowed over him when Bran had found an alternative to killing the human. Her mate was a killer, but he didn't enjoy it. Looking at it clearly, she was a little awed at how he'd managed to be so civilized and still meet the demands of who and what he was required to be. The water was cooling off. She shampooed her hair, enjoying the way the soap rinsed away so easily. Chicago water was much softer. She conditioned her hair with something that smelled of herbs and mint, recognizing the scent from Charles's hair. By that time, the water was starting to become uncomfortably cold. She took a long time combing out the tangles without looking at the mirror and concentrated on feeling nothing. She was good at that, having perfected it over the past 3 years. When she faced him again, she didn't want to be a whiny, scared of herself nitwit again, so she needed to control her fear. She knew one way to do that. It was a cheat, but she gave herself permission, if only for tonight, because she'd made such a fool of herself by hiding in the bathroom. She stared at herself in the mirror and watched her brown eyes pale to silvery blue and back. So much and no more. The strength and fearlessness of the wolf wrapped around her and gave her calm acceptance. Whatever happened, she would survive. She had before. If Charles was a monster, it was by necessity rather than choice. She dressed in the yellow shirt and jeans, then opened the bathroom door slowly. Charles was leaning, still golden-eyed, against the wall opposite the door. Other than his eyes, he was the epitome of relaxation. But she knew to believe the eyes. She'd checked her own with a glance in the mirror before she'd opened the door.
"I've decided you need to know about a seal,"
he told her, as if there had been no break in their conversation.
"All right."
She stayed in the doorway, the steamy room warm at her back. He spoke slowly and distinctly, as if he were pulling his words out from between his teeth.
"Asil's not really his name, though it's what most people call him. They also call him the Moor."
She stiffened. Uneducated about her own kind she might be, but she'd heard of the Moor. Not a wolf to mess with. He saw her reaction, and his eyes narrowed.
"If there's a wolf in this world older than my father, it might be Asil."
He seemed to be waiting for her to comment, so she finally asked, "You don't know how old Asil is?"
"I know how old he is. Asil was born just before Charles Martel, Charlemagne's grandfather, defeated the Moors at the Battle of Tours."
She must have looked blank.
8th century A.D.
"That would make him..."
"About 1,300 years old."
She leaned against the wall herself. She'd seen the weight of age on him, but she'd never guessed how many years.
"So, the one you're not sure of is your father?"
1,300 years was a long time. He shrugged. The answer clearly didn't matter to him.
"Da's old."
He turned his amber eyes away from her face.
"Asil came here a while ago, 14, 15 years, to ask my father to kill him. He settled for the promise of death instead, as soon as my father determines that he really is crazy."
Charles gave her a small smile.
"Asil didn't have any problem with my father being his alpha, but he had a problem with me being more dominant, which is why I think Da might be older than Asil. My relative youth is a thorn in his paw."
Anna worked it out in her head. "Didn't he talk about his alpha in Europe?
And I don't remember him being an alpha in any of the stories about him."
There were a lot of stories about the Moor. He was almost a folk hero, or villain, among the wolves.
"Being an alpha isn't easy," Charles said. "It's a lot of responsibility, a lot of work. Some of the older wolves get pretty good at concealing what they are from others. That's one of the reasons alphas don't like old wolves moving into their packs. Asil's plenty dominant,"
he smiled again, but this time it was more a baring of teeth.
"He'd been here a couple of months when I stepped between him and one of our non-wolf residents. He wasn't amused to find out that I really was more dominant than him."
"He could submit to your father because he is older, to his other alphas because he wasn't really submitting, but to have to obey you when you were so much younger and not even an alpha..."
Charles nodded.
"So he digs at me, and I ignore him. Then he digs harder."
"That's what tonight was?"
Anna could see it.
He was using me to dig at you.
Charles tilted his head in a gesture that was more wolf than human.
Not entirely. The Moor had a mate, but he lost her a couple of hundred years ago. She died before my time, so I never met her, but she was supposed to have been an Omega, like you.
He shrugged.
He has never said so in my hearing, nor has my father. There are a lot of stories about the Moor, and until I saw his reaction to you at Doc's funeral, I put that one down to pure hype, along with a lot of other legends connected to his name.
The warmth from her shower was gone, and the coolness of the water it left behind was chilly. Or maybe it was recalling the way the old wolf had stared into her eyes in the church. Why did his reaction make you rethink it? She could tell from Charles's nod that she'd asked the right question.
Because when he noticed what you are, he stopped bothering you to get to me and became interested in you.
He took a deep breath.
That's why he brought you flowers. That's why, when he threatened to try to woo you away from me, I had such a hard time controlling myself. Because I knew he really meant it.
She decided to think about that later, and keep her attention on the conversation so she didn't push him inadvertently. Why are you telling me about Asiel? Is this a warning? He looked away, his face back in its blank mask.
No.
He hesitated, then said in a softer voice,
I don't think so. Do you feel as if it was a warning?
No, she said finally, as frustrated by the careful information that avoided something she could almost sense, the something that was keeping his wolf so close. Before she could ask what was troubling him, he told her, face averted, as fast as he could get the words out.
He wanted you to know that if in the time before the first full moon, you decide not to have me, you could pick him instead.
Even with his head turned away, she could see the edge of his bitter smile.
And he knew he could force me to tell you so.
Why did you tell me? Her voice was soft. He turned back to her.
It is your right to know that although we are compatible, you can still refuse me.
Can you refuse me?
I don't know. I've never heard of a binding happening backwards like ours. Brother Wolf chose you, chose your wolf, and left me to follow him. But it doesn't matter. I don't want to refuse you.
The wolf gave her a clearer head in some things. But her wolf had chosen this man and made no bones about what she thought of choosing another. She was forced to push her back a little so she could get a clear sense of what he was trying to tell her. And I would do this... why? Did he want her to refuse him? His throat was dry as dust. She, human and wolf both, craved him like a junkie, just as she craved all the things he seemed to promise. Safety, love, hope, a place to belong. She rubbed nervous hands on her thighs, as if that would soothe her tension away. He whispered,
I hope you don't. But you need to be told of your options.
His hands were fisted on his thighs. She smelled something sharp in his scent that she hadn't before. Damn Leo, that he had left her crippled by ignorance. She'd give her right hand to know what Charles was feeling, to know when he was telling the truth, and when he was just trying not to hurt her. He was waiting for her answer, but she didn't know what to say. Options. She tried for neutrality. What did he want of her? Evidently not neutrality. His fists opened and closed twice. Nostrils flared wide. He looked at her with hot, yellow eyes.
Options,
he growled, his voice dropping so that she felt the rumble of it in her chest.
Asiel will spread the word, and you'll be buried in wolves who would be pleased to lay their lives down for the chance of being your mate.
His whole body was shaking, and he leaned harder against the wall, as if he were afraid he was going to try to tackle her. She was failing him. He was losing control, and she wasn't helping, didn't know how to help. She sucked in another deep breath and tried to let it wash away all of her insecurities. This was not a man who wanted to give up his mate. This was a man trying to do the honorable thing and give her a choice, no matter how much it cost him. That was right. And the knowledge steadied her, and she let her wolf come back and give her the confidence she needed. For her, he shook like an alcoholic in need of his gin, because he felt she needed to know her options no matter how his wolf felt about losing his mate, her knight. Indeed. Her wolf didn't like seeing his unhappiness, wanted to bind him to her, to them, with chains and love until he could never think of leaving them again. "Well then," she said as briskly as she could manage under the weight of that revelation, a weight that made her feel warm and safe while her eyes burned with tears. Mostly her voice just sounded husky. "It's a good thing there's something we can do to fix that little loophole. Right now." He stared at her as if it was taking him a while to process what she had said. His pupils contracted and his nostrils flared wide. Then he launched himself off the wall and was on her, his big body pushing her with frightening intensity against the doorframe. His mouth was nipping frantically on her neck. He hit a nerve that sent lightning down her spine, and her knees buckled. As a rich, musky scent rose from his skin, he lifted her into his arms in a jerky, uncoordinated move that banged one of her shoulders painfully against the door. She kept still as he stalked down the hallway with her. She'd seen a wolf in rut before and knew better than to do anything but meekly submit. Except she couldn't help touching his face to see if the ruddy tinge on the edge of his cheekbones was warmer than the rest of him, and then her fingers had to linger on the corner of his mouth, where a small quirk so often betrayed the amusement he otherwise kept hidden. He turned his head a little and closed his teeth on her thumb, hard enough she felt it, but not so hard that it hurt. Maybe, she thought, as he opened his mouth and released her thumb only to move his head and catch her ear in the same light nip that sent a wave of heat from her earlobe that scorched unexpected places. Maybe she was in rut, too. She certainly had never felt like this before. Even though there was no one else in the house, he closed the door with a foot, enclosing them in the dark warmth of his bedroom. Their bedroom. He didn't so much set her down on the bed as fall down with her, making urgent sounds that were more wolf than human while he did so. Or maybe it was her making the noise. He ripped her jeans, getting them off, and she returned the favor. Feeling the heavy cloth part under her hands was satisfying. More satisfying was the warm silk of his skin under her fingers. His hands were calloused, and though he was obviously doing his best to be gentle, they sometimes bit in as he struggled to move her where he wanted without lifting himself off of her. With her wolf in ascendance, he didn't frighten her in the least. The wolf knew he would never hurt her. She understood his passion because she felt the same way, as if nothing was more important than the touch of her skin to his, as if she'd die if he left her. The fear and her usual distaste of sex, even the wolf wasn't bestial enough to do more than endure what those others had done, was so far gone, it wasn't even a memory.
"Yes," he told her. "Soon."
"Now," she ordered him sharply, though she wasn't sure exactly what she wanted him to do. He laughed, and it rattled rustily in his chest.
"Patience."
Her shirt ripped and her bra soon followed it. Then it was her naked skin against his flannel shirt. Frantically, she tugged and pulled at it, popping buttons and half choking him before she got it off. Her urgency seemed to inflame him, and his hands jerked her hips into position. She hissed as he came into her carefully and far too slowly. She bit him on the shoulder for the care he took. He growled something thickly that might have been words or might not have. But only when he was satisfied that she was ready did he release the control he'd been holding on to by fingertips ever since Asil had left. The first time was fast and hard, but not too fast for her. They'd barely finished when he began again. This time, he set the pace and held her back when she would have forced him to speed up. She'd never felt anything like it, or like the satisfied peace that followed her into sleep. She could get used to feeling like this. She woke up in the middle of the night to the unfamiliar sound of the furnace turning on. Sometime in her sleep, she'd rolled away from him. He lay on the other side of the bed, his face relaxed. He was snoring lightly, almost a purr, and it made her smile. She reached a hand toward him, then stopped. What if she woke him up, and he was angry with her for disturbing his sleep? She knew he wouldn't care, but her wolf, who'd helped her through all they had done to her, who had let her enjoy his touch, was sleeping too. Anna curled up on her side of the bed, finally rolling until her back was toward him. Her restlessness must have disturbed him because suddenly he surrounded her, spooning in behind her. The sharp alarm she felt at the suddenness of his move woke the wolf. He threw one arm over her waist. Go to sleep. With the wolf to protect her, she could give herself over to the way his body heat made her muscles and bones relax into the rightness of his presence. She gripped his wrist with one hand and held it over her belly, before letting sleep grab her in return. Hers. When he woke her up, it was still dark outside.
Morning,
he said, his voice a rumble under her ear. It felt so good that she pretended to still be asleep. He wrapped his arms around her and rolled over quickly twice. She managed a squawk as they rolled right off the bed. She landed on top of him, and her hip on his belly vibrated with his silent laughter. Like that, is it? She muttered, and before she remembered his wound, touched her fingers into the muscle just under his ribs.
Quit that,
he mock growled, catching her hand so she couldn't tickle him again. He sounded amused, so she must not have heard him.
We have a job to do, woman, and you're slowing us down.
Ha, she said, and wiggled her hip a little, making them both very aware that he'd probably agree to a delay in getting ready. Then she wiggled a little more determinedly and slipped free of his hold. Morning, she told him. Time to go. And she sauntered naked out of the room and down the hall to the bathroom. He watched her go with appreciation, aware of the spark of true happiness that lit his soul. She didn't look beaten at all this morning, and that little sachet of her hips told him that she was feeling pretty good. He'd made her feel like that. How long had it been since he'd been the cause of someone else's happiness? He lay back on the floor to enjoy it until his conscience kicked in. They had a job to do. The sooner they got out into the woods, the sooner they'd be back and free to play. To that end, he tested out his wounds experimentally. They still hurt, and they'd slow him up a little. But as Samuel promised, he was feeling much better, and not just because of Anna. He was dressed and collecting his winter gear from the closet. He'd have to find someplace else for all of it, so Anna could have half of the closet. When Anna came back in, she was wrapped in a bath sheet, having evidently lost some of her boldness while in the bathroom. He decided to give her some space.
I'll fix breakfast while you get dressed.
Her eyes were on the floor as she skittered past him. If his ears hadn't been sharp, he wouldn't have heard her nervous, okay. But nothing would have kept the rank smell of fear from his nose. He froze where he stood and watched her keep her shoulders rounded in submission as she knelt on the floor by her box of clothes. He tried to open the link between them, but it was no stronger than it had been yesterday, or the day they'd first met. He'd never been mated before, but he knew how it was supposed to work. Love and sex would bind human to human. Then the wolf would choose or not. Since their wolves had already clearly chosen, since he'd chosen, he'd been sure that their lovemaking would seal the bond. He looked at her, the knobs of her spine and the sharp edges of her scapula showing clearly that she needed to gain some weight, a visible sign of the suffering that she'd endured in Leo's pack. The worst scars didn't show. Werewolves seldom scar on the outside. He opened his mouth to say something, but stopped. He needed to think some things through before he even knew what to ask, or of whom to ask it. He fed her breakfast only a little closer to the answers he sought, but even distracted.